The City Club of Boise is a nonpartisan forum dedicated to free speech and the open exchange of ideas on issues critical to the Intermountain Northwest. Founded in 1995, its motto is "Things happen when people start talking." You can find information regarding forums, salons, tours, and opportunities for sponsorship at cityclubofboise.org. Today's moderator is Bill Manny.
Welcome to the City Club of Boise. I'm your moderator, Bill Manny. I'm an editor at the Idaho Statesman and the immediate past president of Boise City Club. I'd also like to welcome our radio audience listening to us on Boise State Public Radio, KBSX 91.5. Our broadcasts are sponsored by the law firm Spink Butler, and we have the principals with us at our head table today, longtime supporters of Boise State Public Radio and our broadcasts. Our annual sponsors are Northwest Nazarene University, Peppershock Media, and Red Sky Public Relations. Our media sponsors are Boise State Public Radio and Idaho Public Television. Please help me thank them. I want to also note this is not the only time you're going to be able to hear about homelessness in Boise. On November 17th, the City of Boise, Boise State, and other sponsors are holding a forum on the state of homelessness here and best practices nationwide. That'll be at 6:30 p.m. November 17th at the Boise State University Alumni and Friends Center. They're going to have Mandy Chapman Semple, who is Associate Director for the Corporation for Supportive Housing, join our own Wyatt Schrader and Diana Lachiando from the City of Boise on that panel. So please plan on attending that. Okay, today, our speaker is Sarah Rankin. She is a professor at the law school at Seattle University. She is director of the university's Homeless Rights Advocacy Project. She has a master's degree in education from the Harvard Graduate School of Education. She has a law degree from New York University. She worked as a lawyer in Chicago. So you might ask, what does this big city lawyer think she's doing telling us about issues in Boise? You might be surprised to know a little about Sarah. She moved to Boise from Fort Collins, Colorado in fourth grade with her sister, her brother, and her mother. And her mother, Barbara, is with us today, along with... She's here, in fact, from Seattle. And she's with Sarah's second mom. And if I get this right, it is Pam Limley. Sarah attended Highlands Elementary. She attended North Junior High School. She attended Boise High School. She worked at the West Side Drive-In. She volunteered at the YMCA. To her mother's dismay, she collected stray dogs. She ran around the foothills. She tubed on the Boise River. She froze up at Bogus Basin. And she ate pizza at the Brass Lamp. And for those real, real old-timers, you'll know that's Highlands Hollow today. To this day, Sarah remains amazed that Idaho let 14-year-olds drive. So Sarah knows a little bit about Boise. But the Boise Sarah knew and the Boise we all knew has changed. For many, many years, Boise was pretty much insulated, at least visibly, from some of the most obvious symptoms of poverty and homelessness. No more. The recession of 2008-2009 left no doubt. Homeless populations, public camping, panhandling, they were no longer invisible. It all came to a head last year when the city closed Cooper Court, the homeless camp down near Interfaith Sanctuary. Before and since, community partners have been working on a plan to address homelessness in Boise. Rapid rehousing, housing first, supportive housing, affordable housing. Those are all words that have become part of our lexicon here. Sarah's work and her research with the Homeless Rights Advocacy Project has persuaded her that bans on camping and other laws similar to that hurt people who are poor. They essentially make being poor in public a crime. She argues that such laws hurt not just the people who are homeless, but they hurt our efforts to help those people, and they hurt society at large. Now, you don't need me to tell you what she thinks. She's here to tell you herself. So let me introduce to the podium Sarah Rankin.
This is so awesome. Seattle's been my home for the last 6 years, but I think of Boise as my home, right? I mean, you know what that's like if you've been away from a special and familiar place for a while, and you go back and you feel overwhelmed with emotions. Some of the things that I've seen, even some familiar smells, remind me. It just transported me back in time. And although I haven't been here for years, I was immediately struck by that sense of belonging. I belong in Boise. So I know you have had this sensation too. Everybody knows this phenomenon. If you think about just take a moment just to reflect on the last time you went back to a special and familiar place. Maybe a field you used to play in with friends as a kid, or a playground. City you grew up in, city you went to college in, a relative's house where everyone always gathers for the holidays, a favorite vacation spot. You know, physically going back to these sorts of places triggers so many emotions and feelings that remind us how crucial a place to belong is to our identity. And a home is a quintessential example of such a place. All of us understand what it means to want to go home. How many times have you said to yourself, I just can't wait to get home? Some of you might be thinking that right now. And that's okay. I'm totally not offended. It's because home means comfort. A little later today, after my remarks, virtually all of us will be returning home to that familiar, comfortable place where we can exhale, a private place that shelters us from the rest of this big, often tumultuous world. Our home is our sacred place to belong. When we open the door of our home, it welcomes us into a place of belonging, the embrace of a partner, the ecstatic celebration of a pet, or maybe the chattering and mess of our children. Home is the heart of our sense of self and privacy. Our home is where we can be messy and relaxed, where we can laugh and cry, where we can truly be who we really are, allowing us to recharge before we go back out into the world. Our home allows us to balance what we must do in public, who we must be in public, with what we need to do at home to restore ourselves. So the very essence of what it means to exist as a human being is to have a place to exist, a place to belong. And yet our laws increasingly prevent many poor people from legally existing anywhere, from having any place to belong. We've created an increasingly popular system of laws that essentially punish our most vulnerable neighbors for not having a home. Leo Tolstoy once famously said that everyone thinks about changing humanity. Everyone thinks about changing humanity, but no one thinks about changing themselves. I'm here today to talk to you about change within ourselves, especially how we react to visible poverty, human desperation, visibly poor people who are suffering. As a lawyer, I'm particularly interested in how we take our fears and impulses and we codify them into our laws and policies. These are laws and policies that serve to make some feel more comfortable, more protected. But at the same time, even in unintended ways, these same laws serve to make others feel more vulnerable, less protected, further marginalized. So today I want to expose some of this process, to challenge us all to recognize how, regardless of our good intentions, and regardless, for many of us, regardless of our very, very hard work, we are all complicit in creating the circumstances within which homelessness and poverty can thrive. We must begin to see the ways that we contribute to this problem. But if we are willing to engage in real change within ourselves, we can stand up together with our poorest neighbors and contribute to some solutions. I mentioned a moment ago about how we codify our impulses and fears in our laws and policies, and in my circles, we refer to this process as the criminalization of homelessness. Criminalization refers to laws that prohibit or severely restrict one's ability to engage in necessary, life-sustaining conduct in public, even when that individual has no reasonable alternative. Examples are laws that prohibit sitting, standing, sleeping, receiving food, going to the bathroom, asking for help, and even protecting oneself from the elements. These are things that none of us could forego for very long and still survive. And yet the act of surviving in public is so tightly regulated that people experiencing homelessness cannot help but get caught up in the web of these laws. They cannot help but somehow trip a wire that incurs significant, potentially life-altering consequences. Criminalization laws don't have to start as a criminal charge. Many do. Many do. Others start as civil infractions, you know, a ticket with conditions or requirements like show up in court, avoid a significant area for a really long period of time, pay a fee. These conditions are extremely difficult for poor and homeless people to meet, and when they fail to do so, not if, but when they fail to do so, because of sickness, lack of transportation, lack of money, mental illness, substance abuse, physical disability, domestic violence, that civil infraction can then mutate into a misdemeanor. And once an individual is saddled with a misdemeanor, they may be ineligible to access food, shelter, services, and other benefits that are intended to help them emerge from homelessness. So by criminalizing the act of public survival, we have actually left these human beings worse off. They're more resistant to recovery. They're more likely to become sick, more likely to self-medicate, more likely to become incarcerated, and even more likely to die. So criminalization comes at a significant cost, not just to the lives and liberties of poor men, women, and children, but to society overall. The vast majority of studies show, they prove, that criminalizing homelessness is far more expensive than investing in the provision of non-punitive alternatives such as permanent supportive housing, mental health treatment, substance abuse treatment. So if it's such a bad idea, why? Why do we persist in doing it? Well, there's many reasons. I think there's a lot of reasons. We could talk for weeks. But the primary contributor that I want to focus on today is the power of our instinctive response to visible poverty and human desperation. We are stained by what I call the influence of exile, deeply ingrained class and status distinctions that can inconspicuously, even unconsciously, guide us to create and enforce laws and policies that restrict the visibility of poverty, of human desperation, of poor people in public space. A wealth of sociological studies show that when we are confronted with evidence of human struggle or desperation, it commonly provokes fear, annoyance, disgust, and even anger from those who witness it. Even neurological tests, you know, where it doesn't matter what you're saying out of your mouth, your brain is firing in response to visual stimuli, even neurological tests prove that when we are confronted with evidence of visible poverty or human desperation, we react with higher rates of negative reactions than when we are exposed to any other marginalized trait, including traits that we historically associate with discrimination, such as race or gender. This fear and disgust that we've specially reserved for poverty, it's frequently codified in our laws and policies. This is what I mean by the criminalization of homelessness. My work and the work of many others catalogs the paralyzing scope of these laws and their dizzying popularity. Criminalization is growing nationwide. The National Law Center on Homelessness and Poverty has been following criminalization laws in 187 cities throughout the country for well over a decade. Their most recent report from 2014 examined the changes in the law in 4 years, just 4 years, between 2011 and 2014. They reported some distressing findings. For example, in those 4 years, citywide bans. I can't even finish the sentence. Wrap your mind around that. Citywide bans. That is no place. No place left in the city. Citywide bans on camping increased by 60% nationwide in 4 years. Understand that in many jurisdictions, including Boise, some of these ordinances are so broadly defined camping that it can encompass even temporary behavior like propping a coat up on two sticks to protect yourself from the rain. Citywide bans on begging, 25% increase. Citywide bans on standing around, 35% increase in 4 years. Bans on sitting or lying down in public increased by 43%. And bans on sleeping in vehicles, the thin, thin line between you and the street, those bans increased by a staggering 119% in 4 years. Our own Homeless Rights Advocacy Project has done a survey of criminalization laws in Washington, and we found the same degree of prevalence throughout our state. We also found some other very distressing observations, such as the fact that a significant number of people were spending 90 days or more in jail for violating these laws. We also determined that as rates of income disparity rise in any particular city, so does the rate at which that city enforces its criminalization laws. In other words, the greater the gap between the rich and the poor in any particular city, the more punitive that space is likely to be for the poor and homeless people within its boundaries. Now, these are just contemporary snapshots of criminalization, but we've been pretty good at it for some time. American history is replete with examples of how even unconscious discrimination and bias can fuel us to create and enforce laws that restrict the visibility of undesirable people in public space. Jim Crow, Antioch laws, sundown town laws, these are just a few notorious examples of the way that we have crafted this art. And we've since rejected these sorts of approaches. And when we reflect on these legal artifacts, we do so with some collective sense of shame. But it's important to note that many of these same historically marginalized groups are disproportionately impacted by criminalization laws today. People of color, single female-headed families, people with mental illness or addiction, LGBTQ youth, people with physical disabilities, immigrants, all of these groups are disproportionately represented in poor and homeless populations when compared to the general population. This disproportionate representation of already marginalized groups suffering from poverty and homelessness is not a coincidence. It's a symptom of the structural inequities that we all create and maintain. Common stereotypes and prejudices quietly influence our judgments regarding someone else's worthiness. And those judgments can even unconsciously affect how we restrict the rights and resources of poor people, in particular, but really visibly poor people, especially. It is the sustained visibility of poverty that prompts us to react. We firmly want poverty and human desperation to remain private. We perpetuate this marginalization through lenses of blame. Studies show that public support or tolerance for a particular group turns on the degree to which we believe that that group is responsible for a particular trait. America is particularly enamored with the bootstrap work ethic, this sort of cheery belief that if you just work hard enough, you are guaranteed to avoid poverty. Over a quarter of Americans believe that the most significant cause of income inequality is the failure of the poor to work as hard as the more affluent. We commonly embrace the fiction that homelessness is simply a bad choice and that people experiencing homelessness do not want help. They do not want something better for themselves. We tend to assume that if someone declines an offer of service, that person deserves their fate. That person deserves society's divestment. They deserve not to be cared about. Even when we talk about emergency shelter, it can serve as a real distraction from the crucial work for long-term solutions. Societally, we rest on the assumption that emergency shelter is a solution, but it isn't. It is a stopgap measure that, in reality, very few of us would choose for ourselves. Is it a reasonable offer of shelter if we require people to give up their family members, their beloved pets, their only sense of community? What about their personal belongings? Should they be required to surrender those? Would you do it? Or are there conditions or requirements that they have to meet? Or put another way, are there senses of privacy, autonomy, or human dignity that we're asking them to give up? Is it a reasonable offer of shelter if we require another human being to give up all these things in exchange for one night of uneasy sleep amongst a bunch of strangers, only to be ejected back out on the street the next morning without any of these things? The bottom line is that we have taught many people to distrust services and shelter. Through experience, many people have learned that emergency shelters do not support their sense of stability, safety, and dignity. This experience is so deeply embedded that even if a real offer of meaningful service comes along, reasonable people in their shoes have already learned not to accept it. They've learned that emergency responses do not create the experience of a place to belong. So the next time we feel incredulous that someone would pass on an offer of services or shelter, we might instead consider the possibility that we often present people with a false choice and then blame them for not taking it. So what are solutions? I'm getting my time notice. Got to hurry through solutions. No problem. If the problem is visible poverty, it should be pretty plain that I think that the answer is not to eject poor people from view, although that is the primary achievement of criminalization. Actually, we want to strive for exactly the opposite. In order to create a meaningful shift in American laws and policies, the crisis of poverty, as long as it exists, must be visible in public space. Proximity is necessary to create social change. How many of you have heard of the book Just Mercy? Oh, I want to see everybody's hands raised next time I come. You should read this book. It was written by a former law professor of mine. His name is Brian Stevenson. He's an amazing person. And he argues that the first thing that we have to do to fight injustice is to get proximate to it. We have to show up and see things with our own eyes. And then we will feel compelled to act. Just as importantly, we can only develop viable solutions to a problem when we have a personal, up-close view of it. So proximity is one of my modest suggestions for how to make real change within ourselves. One simple step that you can make today, and you can make it for people that you love going forward, is to create meaningful and sustained opportunities to get to know someone who's struggling with poverty or housing instability. You can volunteer at the Corpus Christi shelter. You can volunteer at the Interfaith Sanctuary. go on the Boise Ada County Homeless Coalition's website. It's homelesscoalitionboise.com. Almost all of their members need more volunteers. Get to know some of the amazing and inspiring people who suffer from housing instability. And that proximity will change you. It will convert you. And you won't be able to rest until we get the social change that we need. Thank you.
Sarah. For our radio audience, you're listening to a broadcast of the Boise City Club with our guest today, Sarah Rankin, who is a Seattle University professor and an expert on homelessness. Just in defense of the moderator, we do not want to cut off discussion about solutions. So I hope we have a chance to explore that a little more thoroughly. I know, Sarah, that you had a chance to do some tours yesterday, meet with some folks today. Could you just give us a sense of what you've seen about the issues that Boise is facing, some of the options we're considering, and what your kind of first blush reaction has been in meeting and learning about the issue here?
I'm hopeful. I've studied and been up close to homelessness in a lot of different cities, and I'm amazed, actually, at how manageable your problem is. I know it may not seem like it to you, but when you're talking about the difference between Boise and Seattle, your homelessness is somewhere around 2,000, I think, and then the number of people who are chronically homeless is somewhere around 100 to 150 people. That is so solvable. Very, very, very achievable to bring a resolution to this problem. Compared to Seattle, where our number of chronically homeless people is close to 2,000. Important thing for you guys to think about going forward, I'm very excited about the discussion that I hear about Housing First. Who doesn't know what housing, maybe I should flip it so everybody feels positive. Who knows about Housing First? So Housing First is one of a few different options that a lot of cities are experimenting with, and it turns traditional approaches to homelessness on its head. In the past, the way that we've always approached homelessness is to say that if you have any sort of issues, you need to fix those first, and then you're worthy enough to get housing. Housing First, it flips that on its head by saying, you know what, let's give you housing first. And that creates the stability that you need in order to address some of those secondary problems. This issue is by far the most studied and the most proven approach to handling chronic homelessness. So that's something, if you guys built one or two Housing First structures, you could solve your chronic homelessness problem like this. It's amazing to me how within reach that is for this amazing city. Rapid rehousing, I know, is becoming sort of the en vogue approach. How many of you have heard of rapid rehousing? Probably a little fewer. Rapid rehousing is super sexy to the federal government right now because it costs a whole lot less money. The reason it costs a whole lot less money is because you're dealing with a much smaller subpopulation of homeless people who either already have housing or who have very few barriers to housing. So let's say that there's someone who can't afford $200 of their monthly rent, but it's going to take them about 3 months to get to a position where they can. Rapid rehousing would come in and pay the difference of their rent just to keep them in housing, and then it goes away. So rapid rehousing helps people who need very little help, but who need it for a short period of time. There's all sorts of things that I feel very hesitant about with respect to rapid rehousing and whether that would be a good fit for Boise. Certainly, it could probably help some people, but I would caution Boise against catching the federal virus that seems to be going around right now, where a lot of the attention has been turned to rapid rehousing at the exclusion of discussions about Housing First.
So follow up on Housing First. One of the questioners asked, what advice do you have for a successful implementation of a Housing First program? And it cites the CATCH example here. I don't know if you're familiar with that, but how do we make it happen?
Yeah, Jody showed me CATCH yesterday. I think the important thing about Housing First, you can benefit from other cities that have done it successfully. In Seattle, we have a number of very successful Housing First models. In fact, one is called 1811 Eastlake, and it's one of the most studied Housing First properties in the country. We found that housing 95 chronically homeless people saved this city $4 million in a year. And the rates of recidivism in terms of criminal activity and in terms of substance abuse plummeted. It's hard to argue with, you know, long-term sociological methodologies like that that have done cross comparisons. Salt Lake City has had some good experiences too. So my first piece of advice would be sit down and talk to people who live, eat, and breathe Housing First programs. And if you want specific recommendations of some organizations, I'd be happy to give those to anybody who'd like them to come in and offer some guidance.
Several questioners want to follow up on shelter questions. One is, what's the best solution to move from the shelter system to housing? And one is, the city's camping ordinance specifically states that no one will be cited for camping if there's room in a shelter. So is that not a good combination of stick and carrot? And do you think that is a bad law, the way the city does it?
Yes, I think it's a bad law. Sorry. I think it's a bad law because I've seen how my job as a lawyer is to, all we do, I know there's a few other lawyers, you know, all we do is deal with vague, the way that things are written vaguely and exploit it to the advantage of our clients. That's what we do. I worry about the language that says if there's no shelter available. I know from having talked with other people here that if somebody says, you know what, we'll never close our doors to anyone, but they've got people lined up four deep, that's not a reasonable offer of shelter. If somebody says, yeah, there's a shelter bed available 30 miles across town, that's available shelter, but the individual who's being cited has no idea or no way to get to it. Is that a reasonable offer of shelter? So this is what lawyers do. We just sit around and think of ways to get around that sort of language. I would have preferred to see something much stronger and clearer, not just for on behalf of people experiencing homelessness, but on behalf of the city and on behalf of others who are involved in this process. You don't want it to be messy. You want it to be straightforward so people know what the rules are and how to comply with them.
So a questioner asks, can you give an example of a misdemeanor infraction that prevents the homeless from receiving services? So you spoke generally, but can you give us some examples?
Yeah, I mean, go to a number of shelters around here and find out what their barriers are. In a lot of instances, you will find that having a misdemeanor on your record will prevent you from being eligible for certain benefits. It can prevent you from being able to use certain services. It can prevent you from being able to access shelters. There's a report that we did that's on the Homeless Rights Advocacy website, and it's called Shut Out. And it examines a lot of data nationwide about the different barriers to shelter that basically render shelter inaccessible because of these various barriers.
This is not me. I almost said my husband is, and I realized that would sound silly. Questioner asks.
I haven't met him, Bill. Where is he?
My husband is a physician, treated someone at Boise Hospital who had become ill in jail. He was jailed for not being able to pay loitering fines. The hospital was able to find extended family who came and took the man home to die. Using your model, what would have been different for a man like this?
Sorry, they took him home to...
die.
To die.
He was sick.
Right. The number of people that we see, part of the cost, the toll on cities, homelessness is a huge fiscal drain. This is why it never makes sense to me, the discussion or the concern that Housing First is expensive. If you don't pursue an actual solution to the problem, you're paying for it in other ways that cost a whole lot more. High users, and I'm sure that person's husband would be able to say this better than I would, our chronically homeless populations are some of the highest users of emergency medical services. Enormously expensive, tremendously expensive. I think that this sort of approach where people are receive a ticket that they can't pay is offensive to my sense, anyway, of human decency. If you give someone a ticket and you know that they can't pay it and the consequence is a circumstance where they're going to jail for failure to appear or failure to pay, how does that serve any function? It's one of those things that just makes me want to slam my head against a wall. A lot of the recommendations that we have for cities is to make sure that there are provisions in the law that says if it's proven that someone is unable to pay for this sort of offense. I'm not talking about letting people go around and rob or commit murder. I'm talking about the laws that we have in place that impact one's ability to survive because of the necessary consequences of surviving, like sleeping, standing, eating. These sorts of crimes shouldn't be crimes at all. Instead, even if they are, the least a city can do is add a provision that says that it's based upon one's ability to pay.
A couple questions about the way the city handled the Cooper Court last year and what options we have. About 140 residents were dispersed because of public health and safety concerns. Are those not legitimate concerns? And city officials found evidence of widespread drug, mostly meth use, serious sanitation problems, hazardous materials, cleanup crew was called in. How do you deal with that? And has Seattle, where you're from and I'm very familiar with, handled such issues and found a better way?
We have authorized encampments, and that's allowed us to be able to provide wraparound services at some encampments to provide more in terms of sanitation. Spend time with someone who's experiencing homelessness. They'll tell you that they'd rather not poop or pee on the sidewalk. They'd like to have a place to do that in private. And no one likes to talk about pooping or peeing, and here we are at lunch. Sorry about this, but we all do it, right? And so people have to have a place to do that. We've also started to experiment with safe injection sites. The problem I have with the idea of looking at an encampment and saying, let me back up. Public health and public safety are always legitimate issues. Nobody's saying that we shouldn't be concerned about public health or public safety. The challenge is to think further down the line than the removal of people that are causing an issue. To say, if we scooch these people out of here, where are they going? They're going to go someplace else. It's a whack-a-mole problem. So again, until you deal with the problem itself, the problem will persist. It's just going to be something that you won't necessarily have to see. And so far, that's been a deal that we've been happy to broker, as long as we don't have to see someone else's suffering. You're still paying for it, just so you know. Even if you can't see it, you're still paying for it. They're still going to the hospital. They're still dying on the street. They're still suffering in all of the ways that are visible to you. So the removal of an encampment doesn't solve any problems.
So a follow-up on the encampment question. I'm curious what you think of the Seattle solution, how you think it's gone, and then I'll add this question from a Boise questioner. Why will Boise not allow tiny houses or tent encampments?
That's a super good question.
Managed with services to help people get a start.
That was such a good question. I forgot the first part of your question. I would like to ask that same question. City of Seattle, why are you refusing to pursue tiny houses and villages? That's another approach that we've used with good success in Seattle.
City of Boise, you mean?
We've used that in Seattle.
Okay.
Successfully. You mean the challenge? Yeah, Boise, sorry.
Okay, thank you.
And I'll say it more to Seattle. Seattle doesn't like me either. But the thing to think about is there's not one approach to this. You know, we've seen, I just went to the Interfaith Sanctuary yesterday. They've got tiny homes with compostable toilets being unused in an area in back of that facility. And it's because they're not allowed to use them. What sense does this make to anyone? Zoning laws, look, lawyers are the first ones who will tell you laws can be interpreted, laws can be amended. That's what I'm challenging us to do, is to think about thoughtful solutions to how we approach our laws and policies. That shouldn't be happening. It's just unacceptable.
So beyond Seattle, are other communities having successes with homeless camps? And is that a realistic long-term solution?
Yeah, I mean, we argue about this all the time. We paid a consultant a couple $100,000 to come and look at Seattle and tell us really what we figured they were going to say anyway, which we already, most of us who are advocates, disagreed with. So we spend our money in weird ways. Seattle it has some great successes. There's been doing a lot of good things, but we've also been failing at a lot of things. And that's okay. I guess I would want Boise to be a bit bold and not to be afraid of failing at something. Try something. Try housing first. It's not going to be the end of the world if you catch some snafus along the way. You just readjust. That's life. It's no different in homeless or housing policy than it is just in life. You'll learn from that experience, and then you'll be able to pivot as long as you stay committed to the principle that people should not have to suffer, that we should not tolerate human suffering and desperation. And that making it invisible is not the same thing as stepping up and having the courage to come up with real solutions to the problem.
Are we increasing these criminalization laws on homeless people and focusing on them to distract ourselves from racial and gender inequality?
Yes. it's certainly part of it. That's why I was talking about intersectionality. It's a big funky word that I was using to describe the disproportionate representation of other marginalized groups. A lot of people who study this issue see a lot of parallels, and we've also written reports about this. You can actually look at the language of some criminalization laws, and they read just like Jim Crow laws, just like it. The difference is they're not aimed explicitly at people of color, but because of that disproportionate representation, especially in more urban areas, people who are already marginalized are being further marginalized through criminalization laws today.
Questioner asks, I see hardly any refugees in Boise panhandling, leading me to believe that it is only our native-born population that uses this to survive. Why do you think that is?
Oh, they wear signs. You guys have people who wear signs. I'm just being a little snide. I'm just sort of surprised. I'm just sort of surprised. I can never tell, who's coming in from some other place. Panhandling is a really tough topic. Being sort of goofing around aside, it's a really tough topic, and people feel a lot of different ways about it. What we have seen, interestingly enough, is a spike in aggressive panhandling laws. Do you know how aggression is defined in the vast majority of laws that we've surveyed? If someone feels reasonable fear, so it's not keyed off of something that you actually do, that the defendant actually does, it's whether someone feels afraid. And because of the sociological studies that we know that show that if we're confronted with visible poverty, we feel afraid, and most people do, it gets really, really muddy around the definition of reasonable fear. So panhandling, I don't know. I have never looked at the difference between native or non-native populations who panhandle, but I can tell you that I know plenty of people who, make their living that way, and it's a complex issue. We're actually putting a report out on begging laws, begging restrictions this spring.
For our radio audience, you're listening to a Boise City Club broadcast of Sarah Rankin from Seattle University, an expert on homelessness. Several questions about what's going on in Portland and Seattle and around the rest of the country, so I'll try to summarize them and give you a chance to address a couple of them. The mayor of Portland opted against running for another term. There's been considerable political turmoil in Seattle with the council and the mayor. Mm-hmm. What's happening in Seattle politics because of this issue?
So I can't speak so much about what the Portland mayor is doing or why he isn't running for re-election. I certainly know of some of the struggles that have been happening in Portland with respect to homelessness. The city of Seattle is very interesting. We had an anti-encampment sweep ordinance that we had sponsored. We were part of a group along with the ACLU and Columbia Legal Services who drafted some legislation that clearly defined the circumstances within which the city could move someone out of an encampment. And public health and public safety were part of that calculation. But if people are in a place where public health and public safety is not an issue, and the city has no place to move them to, not just to say shelter exists, but actually deliver you to a reasonable shelter that you can otherwise access. In other words, you don't have some sort of barriers that are going to keep you from being able to go into that shelter when we take you to it. In all of these sort of circumstances, that's what the city was supposed to be using to determine when they could sweep people from an encampment. And that helps to balance the interests of the city and in everybody in terms of public health and safety on the one hand, but also realizing that you have to be able to negotiate some sort of reasonable alternative. And as Howard knows, the failure to provide some sort of shelter for folks when there is no reasonable alternative, if you're sweeping encampments in that circumstance, everybody may not be happy to hear me to say this, but it's a violation of the Eighth Amendment, prohibition on cruel and unusual punishment. You're punishing people for being in a situation from which they cannot escape.
One questioner asks about a New Mexico program that picks homeless people up, gives them a day job, feeds them lunch, pays them for their work, and gets them someplace at night, and which I think I'll blend with other questions, which is where in this country whether it's Seattle, King County, other places, Salt Lake City, who's figured this out?
I don't think anybody's figured it out. It's a complex issue. I think it's right up there with, you know, racism and sexism. You know, it's how do you figure those things out? It's very, very difficult. I think the best we can do is to try to mitigate it and to grow as people. Salt Lake City is well known for Housing First. Like I said, Seattle's had some really great work that we've done. We have a safe parking program for vehicle residents. It's sort of like an authorized encampment, but it's with respect to vehicles. We've had some successes there. I like the idea of what New Mexico is doing with offering jobs to people who are able to work. Remember, again, about barriers. Not everybody's going to be able to work. But for people who are looking for a job, I like that sort of approach. Denver's trying it out, too, because it increases proximity. I actually think that cities should look for opportunities to have paid leadership positions for people experiencing homelessness so that we can guarantee that they have direct and regular access to policymakers. Because, after all, proximity is key to social change. And so if there's anything I think that can really help city governments think through it, involve, engage, and listen to people who are living it every day. There's a lot more people who are experiencing homelessness who have incredible wisdom and leadership experience than folks might think.
What do you think about Washington's newly increased minimum wage? And will that have any effect on the homelessness problems in that state? Seattle specifically?
I certainly hope so. I mean, we know for every $100 increase in rent in our city, it increases our homeless population by 15%. So I sure hope so.
If you've already addressed this, you can just say so. But please name some places that restrain from criminalizing homelessness and describe what that looks like.
Places that do it systemically? I'm not aware of cities that do it. Well, actually, I just got an email yesterday that Tacoma, we drafted a report on vehicle residency. I think I mentioned that. And we highlighted their law as unconstitutional. And I understand that the police officers there are now refusing to enforce it. So that's a good outcome. But systemically, I don't know. I think it's a little early to say that there's a city that's systemically doing it. Law enforcement officers, I have to say, from the police officers that we've been working with, they get it. They feel like they're caught in the crosshairs because they know these people that they're interacting with. They know the goodness of the people who are experiencing homelessness, and they have to go up to them and tell them to move, and they know the futility of it. You know, move along, and they know there's no place else for them to go. I was talking to a police officer just the other day who said, and so I told him, Frank, just leave for a couple days. You can come right back. You know, they know. They know this is just a process of moving people in and out and in and out and in and out. And, of course, police time is expensive. Wouldn't you rather they be doing something else than just, participating in this sort of game of shifting people around? It's a very expensive and damaging, traumatizing game to play.
I know from just anecdotally that Boise police have that same reputation, that balance between compassion and, mm-hmm. and enforcement, and that's a fine line to walk, but I think I've heard that they do that well.
Mm-hmm.
Our president-elect has made no mention about homelessness.
Oh, no.
I think we'll keep the next administration for a different day. But what do you think the federal government's attitude has been and should be over the next 4 years? And maybe just talk a little bit about the kind of the sense of federal funding for these kind of programs. And then you can add to that, in Idaho, there are limits on what cities can levy in taxes and other options. So I guess the question is, what's the federal government role, and what do we do in an environment where dollars are always short?
Yeah. I don't know. Was it? Maybe I was talking to you, Howard, about some city that just changed its law so that they could, you know, levy. An Idaho city, I want to say, that has recently changed its law so that can levy resources in a different way. Like I said, laws are just creatures that are generated by human beings, so we can change them, we can move them, right? The question about the federal government is a difficult one. I mean, setting aside my own sort of personal trauma, which is extraordinary, setting that aside, what we know is that historically the federal government has cut its funding to HUD-related programs, to affordable housing programs. That was a huge contributor. I could show you, I had the best PowerPoint slides. But part of what they showed is a chart that shows the funding of affordable housing over time and tracks it with the rates of homelessness. It will blow your mind when you see the overlay, how the divestment of monies from affordable housing, the deinstitutionalization of mental health treatment, coincides with the spike in our homeless population. The federal government does not, in my view, adequately prioritize solutions to homelessness. I am troubled by the new vogue emphasis on rapid rehousing, as I emphasized before. It's not that it's a terrible project, but it's only really good for a certain subset of people. I think the federal government likes it because it's cheaper. And I just don't think we can afford to think about homelessness policies that way, because we miss all of the other expenses. And like I said, there's a landslide of studies that show the same thing over and over again. I don't know if the studies showing that it's more expensive to do what we're doing versus the things that we're afraid of paying for, I don't know if more studies are going to persuade people. We just have to be bold enough to do it.
Questioner asks, I come from a background of property management, of tax credit housing, and I'm disappointed at the lack of affordable housing in Boise and Meridian. Are you familiar with the reason why more of these options are not being utilized?
In Boise, I can't say that I'm particularly knowledgeable about what has contributed to, aside from the things that I've already talked about, what has contributed to the lack of affordable housing. Certainly, federal investments are some of it. The recessions that you highlighted have contributed to the problem. We know that, as like I said before, there's a definite correlation between the cost of rent and the rate of homelessness. So there's a causal relationship between those two things. Affordable housing is extremely important to put as a priority.
Several people, this is a big-hearted group, several people are asking what they can do, and I've got a couple of questions I'll ask in the last few minutes we have. general question, how can we best support our Housing First program?
I think you need to get involved, show up, and vocalize support for it. Your politicians are only going to do what you ask them to do, and they have a vested interest in staying in office. So longer-term solutions like Housing First are hard for them to sign on to because it means the expenses really bit off during their time in office, and somebody else might come in, some other administration might come in. If there's not public support for it, it could be dismantled, right? So I think the most important thing you can do is to be very, very vocal in your support for it. First, you know, get educated about it. It's easy to do. There's so many websites that talk about the results of Housing First. I would love to get Daniel Malone from the DESC, who is one of our Housing First experts in Seattle. I'd love to get him in a room with you guys. You could just pick him apart in a healthy, happy way. There's a lot of people who have tremendous experience with this, and we know that it works. It's not going to be without struggles, and you will have some stumbles as you're trying to figure out the right solution, but we know that it works. So affordable housing and Housing First, show your support for it. Let your elected officials know that that needs to be a priority and that you're willing to put your money where your mouth is in order to solve a problem that not just impacts vulnerable people but impacts all of us.
So we've gotten down to the last question. Before I ask that, I want to present Sarah the new edition and highly collectible City Club of Boise mug.
Oh, that's the best. Thank you. Thank you so much.
Several people have asked varieties of this question, but this one may put it the best. What can I do personally when I drive by a person asking for money, when I see someone holding a sign, they maybe have their family? What can I do? Am I helping or hurting by giving money to panhandlers?
The decision to give money is yours. I think it's too complex to try and hypothesize what any particular person might do with that money. I think the most important thing you can do, money aside, is to say hello. Smile. It's all about, you know, allow yourself. I often say you can't be courageous and comfortable at the same time. And so if you want to solve this problem, you're going to have a little courage. You're going to be willing to be uncomfortable. Talk to people. Reach out to them. Let them know that you see their humanity. And that's the most important donation you can make.
You've been listening to Sarah Rankin, professor of law at the Seattle University, speaking on homelessness in Boise and the nation. Please remember the November 17th forum at Boise State University on some of these very same issues. And December 9th, please come and celebrate the end of the Civility Project with our capstone event, the Stimson Award, going to Congressman Simpson and ICL Director Rick Johnson. Thank you for being here, and we are adjourned.
This broadcast of the City Club of Boise was made possible by funding from the law firm of Spink Butler, LLP. The City Club is a nonpartisan forum with the motto, "Things happen when people start talking." On-demand audio of this and other forums and information about becoming a sponsor is available at cityclubofboise.org. Additional information about membership in the City Club and scheduled tours, salons, and upcoming forums is also available at 208-371-2221. Connect on Facebook and Twitter by searching for City Club of Boise.